And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Kurt Wagner back to the program today for the second half of our two-part conversation. Kurt is an award-winning business and technology journalist covering social media for Bloomberg and has been writing about Twitter and other social media companies and their impacts on society since 2013. Kurt's debut book is Battle for the Bird, which is published by Simon & Schuster. Kurt, thanks for coming back and joining us again to talk about Battle for the Bird.
My pleasure.
So when we left off, Jack Dorsey had returned to Twitter as CEO for his second stint. He's got people honed in on the mission that Twitter is all about live. It's where when things are starting to happen, this is where you go to. That's nice, but how are you making money?
This was sort of always the dilemma with Twitter was culturally, it had this huge place in the world, especially here in the U.S., and the business just never quite caught up to the cultural impact. And so there was always this feeling, I think, from people that Twitter belonged in the same discussions with Facebook and YouTube, sort of these other big tech companies. But financially, Twitter was nowhere close to any of these others. And so I think they kind of struggled because I think people expected the stock to be doing better because, again, they lumped it with these other players and it never really lived up to the expectations. I think regulators and politicians held Twitter to a really high standard, not realizing necessarily that they didn't have the resources that some of these other companies had to do some of these things. So even though, again, Twitter had sort of cemented its place in culture, the lack of business success historically, I think, has really hampered and hindered it.
Now, one of the aims of Twitter and Jack Dorsey was free speech. And free speech, much like a boat, is great as a concept, but the day-to-day reality of having to maintain free speech and a boat are both awful propositions.
Yeah, I think it's a really terrible place to be to have to try and police the internet. I think people underestimate how difficult it is. And there's always these conversations, well, why don't they just ban this person? Or why don't they just keep their hands off and let us say whatever we want, right? There's a million versions of those two statements that we hear all the time. But in reality, it's just so much more complicated than that. Writing a rule book for a user base that is hundreds of millions of people from tons of different cultures and backgrounds and political viewpoints is just really hard. I think that challenge ultimately, you know, wore Jack Dorsey down a little bit. It certainly wasn't a fun part of the job. And you have to remember, and this sounds, again, sort of obvious, but I don't think people always think about it, like this is a for-profit business, right? And Twitter, you know, their goals as a business were to grow the user base and have as many advertisers as possible. And so that comes with an expectation that you're going to police the user base a little bit. And so, you know, if you want people to feel safe there, you have to take stuff down. If you want advertisers to spend money there, you have to take stuff down. And if you truly believe in free speech, that can be a really tough trade-off. And it was one that I think Jack Dorsey struggled with for a long time.
Walmart and Coke are not clamoring to advertise on 4chan.
Exactly. And so you're making these business decisions that might feel like they go against your own personal beliefs about what people can or cannot say online. Everyone draws that line in a different place too, right? So where Jack Dorsey feels about it is going to be different than where you feel about it and where I feel about it. And there were a lot of very passionate people who worked there who struggled with this over the years. And I think, you know, Jack Dorsey eventually was sort of like, this is what makes running this company really tough, is that you can't be idealistic and still have a business.
Now, you mentioned they're a publicly traded company. When that happens, you are vulnerable to what they call activist investors. And could you describe a little bit about that peril that's presented by activist investors and then about the first activist investor in Twitter's history who was not Elon Musk?
So if you're publicly traded and if you, in Twitter's case, as we already talked about, have one class of stock, right? So every share of stock that's purchased comes with one vote. You could see a scenario where anyone with enough money could buy up enough of the stock to have, you know, a significant voting power in the company. And what activist investors do is they find a company they feel is being mismanaged or undervalued, and they buy a bunch of the stock, oftentimes sort of in secret, right? They don't announce they're doing this. And then they show up one day and they say, hey, look, we're your largest shareholder. We want some changes to be done. And basically force the company to maybe change the board or change the CEO or whatever it may be. So this is exactly what happened to Twitter in 2020, is that there was an investment group, Elliott Management, that felt Twitter was being undervalued. And part of the reason was they were upset that Jack Dorsey had two jobs. They didn't like that the CEO of Twitter was also the full-time CEO at Square. So they amassed a very large stake of the company in private. And then they came forward and they said, hey, we own, you know, more than $1 billion of Twitter stock. We're now one of your largest shareholders and we want to see some changes. Can we set a meeting? And ultimately, Elliot's goal was to kick Jack Dorsey out of his job and put in someone who was going to be full-time CEO. This was a hugely pivotal point of Twitter's story because not only did it change the way that Jack Dorsey felt about running Twitter, but it created a huge distraction. It created a blueprint where now anyone realized, oh, if I buy enough Twitter stock, I can come in and demand a bunch of changes and get them done. And Elliot proved that to be true.
Jack Dorsey, with all this being conflict avoidant as he was, what did he start to do in his lack of doing things that kind of made his ouster inevitable?
Well, so after Elliot comes in, they try and boot Jack out of his job. And ultimately, the board saves his job in the short term. They make some concessions. They, you know, agree to these lofty business goals. They bring one of the Elliot management investors onto the board of directors to sort of sit there and watch over Jack. But, you know, what that whole process did was it sort of killed Jack's, I would say, enthusiasm or excitement for running this company, right? He sort of was on a performance like improvement plan and, you know, he started to get distracted, right? We talked about how he was someone who really cared about other hobbies and interests. You know, now that he has all of these new kind of expectations at his day job, he starts to focus on things that are unrelated to Twitter. The first and main one being Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency that most people have probably heard of. And Jack Dorsey is one of its biggest proponents. And, you know, after Elliot came in and sort of said, hey, we expect a lot more from you, he started to check out and spend a lot of time doing other things. And ultimately, I think that was what, you know, led to his eventual departure from the company about 18 months later.
And for a board that wants you to spend more time on the company, saying you're going to live in Africa for 6 months is not exactly going to engender a lot of confidence in you.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about that. So this happened right before Elliot showed up as the largest shareholder, was that Jack Dorsey had tweeted, unbeknownst to anyone on the board or at the management of his companies, that he was going to spend 6 months living in Africa. And you can imagine, right, for people who already felt that he was a part-time CEO and, you know, that Twitter was struggling because of that, to suddenly hear him say he wanted to live in Africa for 6 months was not a very reassuring signal that he was committed to the company. Now, he kind of got out of this statement because COVID happened. And so he says he's going to live in Africa. There's this big backlash because everyone says, well, he's super distracted. What's going on? And then COVID happened and he sort of said, well, you know, given everything that's going on in the world, it's best that I stay put. But it would be interesting to see an alternate reality where if COVID hadn't happened, how he would have tried to finagle that, because, you know, I think he was pretty committed to going to Africa. And I think the board would have been pretty committed to keeping him here in the United States.
And I think that phrase, unbeknownst to others, is something that echoes throughout the entire book. There are these two men who make a lot of decisions and actions and really don't talk them through with other people.
Well, this is what happens when you are a billionaire and you've achieved massive success, is that you sort of start to feel that, you know, you don't have to answer to anybody else. I think, you know, Jack did that somewhat in his personal life. Clearly, the Africa thing was a very personal decision for him. And he felt, well, who's there to say no to this? But I think Elon does this even more often and more regularly, right? As he just simply says, this is the way I want to do things. And this is how we're going to do them, because who's there to tell him no, right? When you have that much power and money, you're not used to asking anyone for permission.
Now comes along our second activist investor, one Mr. Elon Musk, and he started buying shares. He didn't do some necessary federal paperwork when he reached a certain level. Can you describe this 5% level and how he didn't do that? And were there supposed to be any repercussions from not doing it properly?
I'll take one small step back before we get there, which is to say that, okay, we're now in January of 2022. Jack Dorsey has just resigned from Twitter. As we talked about, he got distracted with Bitcoin and other things and sort of went on his way. There was a moment in January 2022, which I think is important to call out, which is that Elon was very bothered by an account on Twitter called @ElonJet. And this was an account that followed his private plane. And so when he took off or landed, there was a tweet that would post to say, you know, Elon's plane just took off from San Francisco and, you know, landed in Miami or whatever. And he hated that people were tracking his plane. So he complained to the company, to Jack Dorsey's replacement, Parag Agrawal, the CEO, and asked them to remove the account. and Parag essentially ignored that request. And shortly thereafter, Elon Musk started buying Twitter shares. And the timing's really interesting. Can't say for certain that the Elon Jet scenario is what ultimately led him to start building a stake in Twitter. But there are several people I've spoken to who do believe that that was a huge factor in why he suddenly wanted to be a Twitter shareholder, was that he wanted some influence over the company's sort of decisions around the Elon Jet account. I'll just share that as a little background because I think it's important. Now, he starts buying Twitter stock every single day, starting at the end of January 2022. And by March, he shows up as the company's largest shareholder, similar, as we talked about, to how Elliot did it. He sort of did this whole thing in secret. The company wasn't aware that he was doing it. The difference is with Elon, he was supposed to have announced that he was a 5% shareholder of Twitter when he reached that threshold. The Securities and Exchange Commission requires that when an investor buys more than 5% of a company, that they basically file paperwork that publicly discloses that. But Elon didn't do that. He just kept buying Twitter shares in private without ever disclosing that stake. And what that enabled him to do was continue to build his ownership at a cheaper cost. Because as soon as he announced he was a Twitter shareholder, the stock price went way up because suddenly a bunch of people said, wow, Elon believes in Twitter. I'm going to believe in Twitter too. So when he didn't disclose things at his 5% threshold, he was able to continue to buy shares at a discount, essentially. Eventually, the SEC is actually investigating whether he violated the rules by not doing that. But it was a kind of a sneaky way of making his investment go a little bit further and also sneaking up on Twitter. Because if he'd announced his ownership at 5%, they would have had, you know, several more weeks of a heads up that he was now a big shareholder.
And he had already had his run-ins with the SEC before. He's been chastened legally many times.
He has. And ironically, they were through tweets. So a few years before that, he had tweeted that he wanted to take Tesla private at, you know, I think it was like $420 a share or something like that. And he said he had the money secured to do this. And so, you know, that obviously influenced the stock price because now a bunch of people are thinking that someone's going to buy all their Tesla stock at $420. It turns out he didn't have the money secured in the way that he had said. So he had sort of manipulated the stock price through his tweets, and the SEC ultimately sued him over this and they settled, but Elon had to give up his chairmanship at Tesla. So he was no longer allowed to be the chairman of the company as a result of that. You know, so the SEC, I guess, to your point, was very familiar with Elon Musk by the time this Twitter situation arose.
He says he wants to buy the company, then he doesn't want to buy the company. This whole saga was like the worst soap opera.
It was pretty remarkable to see happen. And it really felt like a movie script because I'd never seen people sort of behave this way when it was real business and real dollars and cents on the line here. But yes, he agreed to buy Twitter in April, almost immediately started to have this buyer's remorse. If you remember April of 2022 and then May of 2022, it was a really tough financial situation for the stock market. Inflation was way up. The Ukraine-Russia war was just getting started. And, you know, essentially he realized shortly after agreeing to buy Twitter that he'd made a bad deal and that his own net worth was taking this huge hit and he was going to rely on that net worth to pay this $44 billion. And so he tried to get out of the deal, right? He started to come up with reasons why he would walk away from Twitter and not have to fulfill the obligation that he'd made. And eventually he tried to call the whole thing off. And Twitter actually sued Elon Musk in the summer of 2022 to say, well, you've already signed a contract. You can't just walk away. We're going to force you to buy the company. So that is sort of the backdrop of him arriving at Twitter several months later is actually this forced sale that Twitter's executive team and board ultimately did to Elon.
Instead of having the thought saying, oh, we dodged a bullet, Elon Musk isn't going to take us over, they were probably going, this is our one chance to get paid out of this whole thing and not everything fall apart.
That's exactly right. The board, from my understanding, was not sitting here thinking, hey, what is Elon's ownership going to mean for the future of this social network? Or what is it going to mean for the value that Twitter provides to society? They were simply thinking about the shareholders, right? They had a fiduciary duty as board members to try and make shareholders as much money as possible. And so when Elon tried to walk away from the deal, they said, well, if he walks away, what's going to happen? He's going to sell his large stake in the company and the stock's going to tank. We're clearly in a tough economic environment, as we pointed out. We're probably going to erase billions, if not tens of billions of dollars of shareholder value by letting him walk away. And as fiduciaries of this company, we can't let that happen. So their motivation was purely financial, right? They were looking to make Twitter shareholders as much money as possible. And that meant forcing Elon Musk to overpay for this company as he had originally agreed to.
What was the market capitalization of Twitter prior to his starting to buy shares, and how much did he end up paying for it?
He obviously ended up paying $44 billion for Twitter. And I think his offer was something like a 35% increase over the stock price from when he had announced that he was the largest shareholder. So, you know, we could do some backtracking from that. That would be what, around $30 billion maybe. So he was paying like a pretty nice premium on the company, which again is part of why the board was so committed to making sure this deal got done, because they're sitting here saying, okay, we can either value this company at $44 billion as he agreed, or if he walks away, you know, I don't think it's crazy to think the stock would have been cut almost in half, just given one, he was going to sell his shares, and two, the broader kind of market environment at that time. So, you know, they're trying to secure an extra, we'll say $20 billion onto this deal, which is part of why they were willing to go to court about it.
Now, Twitter had set some pretty ambitious goals as far as revenue leading up to all of this, and it looked like they weren't going to hit them. One of Musk's intentions in buying Twitter was also, he said, to cut down on the bots, artificial automated users of the service that kind of pump up numbers and such. Then he tried to back out of the deal because of said bots.
Yeah, there was a pretty tremendous irony here, which is he'd been talking about Twitter bots for years. This is kind of a fun story. He showed up at a Twitter company-wide retreat in 2020 and complained about bots on the service, right? So very, very aware of the fact that, you know, there are bots on Twitter. And in some cases, those bots are, you know, a negative experience. They kind of promote spam or whatever. So then when he buys Twitter 2 years later, he suddenly says, wow, there's all these bots on here. There's more bots than I even thought there were. You know, Twitter's been lying about its user base, and I'm going to try and get out of the deal. And it was just sort of, again, you know, there's a lot of irony throughout the book, as I'm sure you saw, but this was yet one other stark example of someone who very clearly and publicly acknowledged a problem. And then when he wanted to get out of the deal, tried to use that very problem as the reason for getting out of the deal. And it obviously did not work, but it was very interesting to see him sort of try and sway public opinion by claiming that Twitter was lying about how many bots were on its service, simply because he knew that it would help him, you know, with his business deal.
And I saw a recent item in the news that was very appropriate for all this. There's a cybersecurity firm called Check, and they estimated that all the traffic coming from X, which is Twitter, is supposed to be known as today, to advertising partners was 75% bot during the Super Bowl.
Oh boy, I hadn't seen that, but that is not obviously a great signal of where the business is, right? Because if you're an advertiser, this exact scenario is why Elon was so adamant about trying to get out of the deal, right? Is imagine if you think you're reaching 100 real people and 50 of those people are not real people. They're just simply automated accounts. You know, you're spending money to reach half the audience you think you're reaching. And so this was Elon's argument for why he wanted to get out of the deal, was he was saying, hey, there's way more bots than I thought. Therefore, this company is not as valuable as I thought because I can't make as much money on advertising. So if indeed, you know, most of the traffic going to advertisers is coming from bots while he's there running it, I mean, as we've said several times now, a lot of irony there.
Musk was, you know, supposed to be there as the paragon of free speech. But as you mentioned, he wanted to get rid of the account that followed his jet, and his skin seemed to be as thin as possible because he didn't appreciate when people exercise their free speech at his own person.
Yeah, he is, you know, a self-proclaimed free speech absolutist, but when push comes to shove, you know, he is uncomfortable with speech that is either critical of him or that he feels is going against, you know, things that he's trying to accomplish. So another good example, you mentioned the Elon Jet account. He took over Twitter and very shortly thereafter banned that Elon Jet account that was tracking his plane. Even though that was publicly accessible information, he didn't like that the account was sharing his location in real time. He also suspended some journalists who had been covering the Elon Jet account or posting the Elon Jet account to their own Twitter accounts. So, like, you know, basically, if anyone is doing something that bothers him personally, that's where he draws the line on free speech. And there's a small detail in the book that I thought was really interesting and worth calling out. It was about a week after he took over, and advertisers, some of them were starting to pause their advertising on Twitter while they sort of figured out, like, what is this new owner going to be like? the ones who weren't pausing, who were still running ads on Twitter, were starting to get sort of harassed by users, right? So people would respond to their ads and say, why are you giving Elon Musk money, and sort of harassing them. And Elon sent a text to his head of ad sales and his head of trust and safety and basically said, hey, these users that are harassing our advertisers, we need to suspend them, right? Because they're hurting our business. And the executives kind of pushed back because they're like, listen, it's not great. It is hurting our business that, you know, users are attacking our advertisers, but there's also nothing we can really do about it. You know, people push back on advertisers all the time. There's nothing against our rules that says you can't, you know, criticize an advertiser for how they choose to spend their money. And he ultimately backed off of the idea, but it kind of gives you a sense of his mindset that he's a free speech absolutist, but if you're going to criticize, you know, someone who's making money for him, he'll shut off your microphone right away.
And then he ultimately becomes the biggest critic of advertisers just a few months later, saying very unkind things about advertisers and those who choose not to advertise with them. He tells them what they can do.
We talked about sort of this brand advertising and how important that is to Twitter. And a lot of those brands, as we've pointed out, they don't like to be associated with questionable or inappropriate content. And so as a lot of them have started to pause or pull back from Twitter, Elon has taken that very personally. And as you alluded to, there was an event this past November of 2023, where he was on stage at a conference and was sort of asked about this and advertisers pausing. And he, you know, looked into the audience and he said, you know, to those advertisers who are pausing, go F yourself. He used the word that I did not there, but this is someone who, again, is trying to make sure that advertisers feel safe, that they want to spend money on their platform. And here he is telling them publicly to, you know, F off. I think this has ultimately been the biggest downfall of Elon Musk's takeover is his inability to sort of recognize that his own behavior is hurting the business. And recognize that his own tweets and his own statements push advertisers away. And that makes it really hard for Twitter to be self-sustaining if all those people no longer want to work with you.
His previous industries of electric automobiles and launching payloads into space don't require a lot of public goodwill. But advertising, which Twitter is an advertising platform, if you don't have goodwill, you don't have a business.
You know, I'm going to paraphrase a post from a former Twitter and X executive. Her name is Esther Crawford, and she worked for Elon for maybe 4 months, I think, before she was ultimately laid off from X. But she said something that I thought was like a really astute way of thinking about this. I'm paraphrasing now, but she says, Elon is phenomenal at solving technical or physics-based problems, which is ultimately what you have with SpaceX and Tesla. But she said, you know, running a global communications platform requires a different type of social emotional intelligence, right? It's soft skills that are required to run Twitter. You have to understand culture and you have to understand human behavior and how people treat each other and how people are going to respond to how other people treat them to sort of run a platform like this and a business like this. And I thought that was really astute because I think that Elon is very talented when it comes to engineering problems. And he also works very hard. So he can sit on the assembly line at Tesla and sleep there and crank out as many cars as humanly possible. But that's just not how you fix Twitter. That's not how you run Twitter. It's a different type of business with a different type of problem. And I'm not sure that it really fits with his personality.
His sense of humor kind of makes Beavis and Butthead look like they should have been at the Algonquin Roundtable.
I've said it's sort of like, you know, middle school humor, like 12-year-old boy humor, right? Like a lot of butt jokes and penis jokes. And he says a lot of misogynistic things about women that obviously don't go unnoticed, certainly by some of the women who used to work for him. You know, I suppose there are people online who simply, you know, say, oh, that's just Elon being Elon, or you know, they find that stuff funny. But when you're the face of a company that's trying to run a brand advertising business, it is so detrimental to what they're trying to accomplish because the last thing Coca-Cola wants to do is have their ad appear right next to, you know, Elon Musk's latest joke about penises, right? Or whatever he chooses to joke about that day. You know, so he scares people away with this. And I don't necessarily see that behavior changing anytime soon. And so as a result, I'm reluctant to say that their advertising business is ever going to totally rebound.
Now, one of the mantras of Silicon Valley is move fast and break things. But that shouldn't be your own code base, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was Meta, or I guess formerly Facebook's motto, has taken a lot of heat for that over the years, right? Because it sort of has come to represent that tech companies are moving so quickly, trying to make profits, trying to grow, trying to launch new products, that they certainly don't think about the consequences of those things, right? The breaking part of that. I do think that is applicable to Elon. You know, he has moved really quickly since taking over X. He's tried really hard to change things dramatically. And there are consequences to what he's done. He either doesn't think them through or doesn't care. And I tend to think he just doesn't really care, right? He sort of says, this is the way we're going to do it, and forces it through. So the whole move fast, break things, you know, started as a Facebook thing several years ago. But I do think it's probably applicable to what Elon's done with X.
Before Elon came on board, there was the reaction to the riot at the Capitol on January 6th. Also, prior to that, the anti-vax and anti-restrictions during the COVID lockdown crowd. And of course, they went out and started Truth Social and Gitter and Parler. And then when Elon comes in, people start going away. There's Threads and Mastodon and Jack Dorsey's own Blue Sky. Why do you think those other attempts to dethrone Twitter haven't been successful?
It's hard to replace something that has such a head start in this particular industry, because so much about what makes a social networking platform both usable and attractive to users is, you know, the social graph, right? The fact that you already know people on there, that you've already taken the time to set up an account, that you feel that you can find people you want to hear from somewhere. And I think Twitter, for all of its flaws, or now X, for all of its flaws, you know, just has such a head start on the social graph element. And so there's a lot of people reluctant to leave because they say, well, I don't want to leave all my followers behind. Or, yeah, it's not perfect, but at least I know this is where I can hear from, you know, my favorite journalist or my favorite athlete or my favorite musician. And so when you're trying to start one of these things from scratch and compete with a Twitter or a Facebook or an Instagram or whatever, it's really hard to get the audience to buy in at the same time. You know, you have the early adopters, but a lot of times people go show up, they say, huh, there's not really all that many people here. And then they leave, or they never gave it another chance. And I think that's what we're seeing, right? We're seeing a splintering of the social media universe right now. But, you know, no one new has really figured out a way to get everyone in one place at the same time. So as a result, you have a lot of people kind of like peeking in the door and then turning around and walking away.
I think one really telling part that really was passed as prelude was talking about Elon Musk's father being a very angry man who had a tendency to go on tirades about social groups he didn't think much of. And seems like the acorn does indeed stay pretty close to the tree, even if you fly across the Atlantic Ocean.
You know, one of the things that I thought was really telling was Elon had a tough upbringing, grew up in South Africa, and I don't think it was tough in, from a financial standpoint. I believe his family had money, and I don't think he was ever really wanting for anything in that regard. But from what I've read and heard, his home life did not really provide much love, right? His dad sounds like probably, you know, allegedly emotionally abusive. I think he never really felt that kind of connection to his dad. And I heard him give an interview a few years ago. And I should also say that in school, he would get in fights. He was beat up. He's talked publicly about literally being like pushed down a flight of concrete stairs and as a middle school student and getting jumped by people. So, you know, this is someone who sort of like grew up in a very rough emotional and physical environment. And he said something at an interview recently where he said something like, you don't care about words once you've been punched in the face. And I feel like that's the approach he's taking to running Twitter, right? Is he's sitting here saying, none of these words that people are posting should have any impact on anyone else because they're not physically hurting them. And I think it just shows a lack of emotional intelligence to think that words can't be hurtful, and that words and the things that people put on Twitter can't be hurtful to other people, especially other groups that might be persecuted, right? And so I think his upbringing is important to understand, because I think it shapes the way that he thinks about these things today, which is that, you know, no one should be bothered by a little criticism online because, you know, sticks and stones type of thing.
I mean, he can't even be honest to that thought because he suspends people who badmouth him, you know, numerous times.
Right. And then we have examples of him saying, well, I disagree with your words, and so I'm going to boot you off, right? I don't know if they're actually hurting him, but they're bothering him enough that he wants those people gone.
One of my favorite tweets about Elon Musk in 22 or 23, the tweet was, 2008, Elon Musk is the next Henry Ford. 2023, Elon Musk is the new Henry Ford.
Yeah, it's amazing how the reputation can evolve, right? I think what's been interesting is that Twitter provides such a public glimpse into Elon's personality and into his psyche in a way that I don't think people ever really got to see before. You know, they knew Elon as the Tesla guy, and they knew him as someone who was fighting to fight climate change, but they didn't really hear from him all that often because the vast majority of people aren't reading Elon Musk interviews all the time. But Twitter has sort of changed that because it's sort of provided this like constant update directly from his brain into the universe. And I think it's just really changed the way a lot of people think about him. And it's been interesting to watch. And I will be interested to see moving forward how his reputation and how his legacy is ultimately impacted by what he's done and it continues to do at X.
So how much money would it have taken you to take Linda Yaccarino's job?
Ah, that's funny. I think running Twitter or X would be a really, really tough job. Gosh, I mean, I'm not going to actually put a dollar amount on it. It would be a lot of money. And I think like it sounds glamorous. And I think a lot of people over history have thought running Twitter would be really fun. And then you get in there and you realize all the crap you have to deal with, right? Around content moderation, around pressure from advertisers and politicians. And then you add in the pressure of working for someone like Elon Musk. And that job to me sounds really miserable. So I hope she's being paid a lot of money because I'm not sure it'd be worth it otherwise.
Have you already started gathering material possibly for the paperback release of the book?
Oh, yes, of course, because I still cover X on a daily basis. So, you know, everything that I'm doing on my day job is sort of being filed away for potential updates in the future. I think I mentioned at the very beginning that I loved writing the book. It was really fun. I'm so glad I did it. But the thought of doing another one is a little too daunting for me to wrap my head around right now. So even the paperback update feels a little overwhelming. So talk to me. Let's give it a couple months and we can talk about it then.
Well, Kurt, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to talk with us about your new book, Battle for the Bird.
Yeah, thank you for giving me so much time to talk about it and for all your thoughtful questions. It was fun to be here.
Kurt Wagner is the author of Battle for the Bird, which is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.